go on into several other areas, and I thought these were very interesting and very useful, and I thought you did a terrific job with them, starting with spiritual development. And one of the things that we find is that spiritual development can mean several different things.
Mm-hmm.
And you give four of them, which are indeed four of the most common. Spiritual development can be looked at as a peak experience, an extraordinary state experience. It can be looked at as a quality that one has, like love or compassion. It can be looked at as an extraordinary development in any of the lines. It can be looked at as the transpersonal levels in any of the lines. It can be looked at as a line itself, such as James Fowler's work on stages of faith. And there he's looking at these third-person structures of consciousness as they unfold in relation to spirituality. But there's also the contemplative definition of spirituality, which gives access to mystical and transcendental states. And these indeed do involve not structures of consciousness, but states of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And you are one of the few people that I've seen who gives the five major state stages of spiritual development. And what that comes from is that the contemplative traditions worldwide generally say that men and women have at least five natural states of consciousness that are available to them. They have waking, they have dreaming, they have deep sleep, they have ever-present witnessing, and they have non-dual, unity, oneness. And these are very important states. For the average person, they simply come and go. One is in the waking state for a while and then goes into dream state and loses consciousness, and in deep sleep loses consciousness and is not aware of their ever-present witnessing or I-amness and is not aware of their state of oneness. But meditation is a process that trains in taking wakefulness, which starts out identified with the waking state, and moves it through these subtle or dream states. So you might start lucid dreaming and becoming aware of the dream state, and also changes in the waking state, and then moves it into formless or deep states of absorption, and then awakening to the witness or I amness, and then awakening to suchness or non-duality.
Mm-hmm.
And so we say that where these structures of development, in the developmental lines, are how we grow up. Moving through states, these state stages of spirituality, are how we wake up. And you give these five stages of spiritual state stage development. In other words, what each state looks like when it moves from being just a temporary state to a permanent acquisition. We can permanently move your consciousness from waking to dreaming to deep sleep to witnessing and so on. And I thought that was very impressive. So I'll give just a few sentences of your description, which is more detailed, in each of these five stages. So gross waking. The initial level of spiritual awakening is called the gross waking or psychic state stage and marks the major transition from a complete identification with the material world and the physical body into the spiritual realm. It emerges with the realization that you are defined by neither your body with its needs, impulses, and emotions, nor your material possessions or social status. Instead of having knee-jerk reactions to inner habits and other people's behavior, you increasingly learn how to stay present and how to respond in mindful ways. Stage two, subtle dreaming. The subtle dream stage is entered by grace or through a regular spiritual practice such as meditation or contemplative prayer. It emerges with the realization that you are not your thoughts and beliefs. Similar to awakening from a dream after sleeping, you realize that random and unobserved thoughts, assumptions, projections, etc., which are frequently fed by pain from the past and fears of the future are just as unreal as your dreams at night. People who enter the subtle state stage, awaken from this nightmare or cognitive prison, and learn to recognize their random thoughts as unreal objects in consciousness. Stage 3, the causal deep sleep. Causal formless state is likened to deep dreamless sleep, is experienced as a timeless openness or emptiness with a realization that you are not your feelings, happy, sad, afraid, content, etc., intuitions or intentions. It becomes a state stage with the arising of a permanent sense of I amness that observes and therefore transcends time and separation. Then the fourth, witnessing. The witnessing state is entered when the observer that experiences the timeless emptiness of state stage 3 drops away. In Zen, this experience is called Satori, radical emptiness, the cloud of unknowing, beginner's mind, or the vertical drop. And the slight correction that I would suggest there is that it's the falling away of all witnesses that can be observed or any objective sense of self whatsoever. And what remains is just the pure witness. And that's why it's just called Turiya. In Sanskrit, it just means the fourth, which is the fourth state, is the true self or the absolutely pure witness. Zen Master Shibayama calls it absolute subjectivity. Mm-hmm. It's the seer that can never be seen because it's pure itself, pure emptiness and pure openness.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fifth is a complete falling away of that witness and becoming one with everything that it witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
As you correctly put it, non-dual awareness is not as much a state stage as it is emerging of the ever-present infinite ground of all the previous levels. In the preceding witnessing state stage, one can become completely absorbed in blissful emptiness and oblivious to all form. In non-duality, both are integrated. Emptiness manifests as form, and form as emptiness. And so I think you did a really good job with that, and I think it's certainly a unique factor in any of the relationship books that I've seen. And although state stages of spirituality are, let's say, not as important as levels, because nothing is, nonetheless, these are very real differences in how people see the world. And they can actually have a very profound impact on relationships. Somebody at a significantly different state stage in spiritual development is just going to see things differently and to some extent be irritated by individuals who aren't as developed and are constantly worrying about things that a higher state stage shows to be really illusory and not real.
Yeah. And, of course, for men, a lot of women say, I want a man who's spiritual, but just reading that chapter, it really informed a man that there is many different forms and ways of being spiritual, and, again, he can have a more intelligent conversation with a woman, what it means to her.
Right. And that's a good point. I mean, it's at some point, one of the items that he can discuss as he's looking for things to discuss other than intercourse is indeed, you know, what's your idea of spirit and what do you think spirituality is? And
mm-hmm.
do you have a spiritual practice? Do you think it's
right.
important? This is what I do. What do you think about that? And so on.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of the things that I think the book is very good at pointing out is that relationships really are a unique arena of growth and transformation
mm-hmm.
for men and women. And we really, there's no other place or practice or situation that puts men and women in a situation where they have as many opportunities to grow and transform and evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it's including spirituality in a relationship is certainly something that you want to at least consider and
mm-hmm.
at some point discuss.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Then you give a very interesting discussion of the development of sexuality. And you, for no absolute reason other than it's convenient. You give five stages.
Mm-hmm.
And these, you say there are five general levels of sexual exchange between partners that are a direct reflection of their physical, psychological, and spiritual health.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to the unfolding of the spiritual realizations outlined above, these levels can be experienced as a temporary state or become permanently accessible state stages through practice with a partner.
Mm-hmm.
The first is repressed sexuality. In this lowest stage, the body and sex are viewed with suspicion as something negative and dirty. Second stage, fucking. In the fucking stage, sexuality is instinctual, self-serving, and limited to the physical, hedonistic pleasures of the body. Three, having sex. In this stage, mindfulness comes into play. Sex becomes a conscious choice between a couple that has a mutual understanding and agreement about the implications and consequences of being sexual. Four, lovemaking. In the lovemaking stage, a couple's sexuality becomes the expression of their genuine love, mutual acceptance, deep emotional intimacy, and the joy of being together.
Mm-hmm.
And then five, transcendent sex. This stage, essentially the highest stage, represents all advanced sacred or tantric practices that lead to spiritual state experiences through sexual union, such as kundalini, that transcend the lower sense of separation from each other and the universe. And of course, that's a desirable and, in a sense, ultimate goal of sexual union. And the techniques for practicing sex in this fashion are quite widely developed and are now pretty readily available in any bookstore.
Yeah, it's amazing that you know, these are thousands of year old Vedic practices, I think.
Yeah.
Vajra Tantra and Kama Sutra.
Yeah. And of course in many of the really highest tantric sexual practices, the point is that there is no orgasm. Orgasm is endlessly delayed,
mm-hmm.
and the energy transmuted in
mm-hmm.
the higher chakras and higher levels and stages of consciousness,
yeah.
Whose bliss far outshines the typical orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
In the West, it's been turned into how to have great big orgasms, which is, you know, okay.
Yeah.
People should understand that there are some subtler distinctions here,
yeah.
that are available. Then you give a very useful, I think, discussion on anima and animus complex development.
Mm-hmm.
These are the contrasexual image in a male is a feminine image, and in a woman, in a female, is a masculine image.
Mm-hmm.
You say about that, in development, little boys soon learn that they are not like mother, painfully dissociate from her, and identify with father figures, while little girls learn that they are like her, but not like father, who becomes somewhat of a mystery to them. Carl Jung discovered this split off and called the disowned feminine in males the anima, and the disowned masculine in females the animus. The parts of these disowned and therefore unconscious realities that are not recognized and reclaimed in later life appear as inward shadows that cover parts of the soul and consequently become outward projections onto the opposite sex, which is called a complex. Now, if you pick up, of course, a book on based on Jungian theory, then you'll find this topic mentioned and emphasized. But otherwise, it's also a topic that doesn't tend to get the attention it deserves, because clearly the unconscious ideas and images and feelings that a man has about a woman and the unconscious images, ideas, and feelings that a woman has about a man are going to play an extraordinarily important role in their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to project these images onto each other.
Yes.
And see things that aren't even there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to relate to that as if it's real, And, of course, this is going to absolutely confuse their partner and throw the relationship into a great deal of discord and otherwise cause just sort of endless problems. So this is something that, that men and women really need to take seriously, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And for that part, I want to give credit to Paula Young Eisendrath, who wrote a great book called Female Authority. And she's a Jungian and I think studied with Jane Lovinger, Jungian developmentalist. And I was really glad when I found that book. So.
Wow. That's a rarity. Good for her. She was basically alive to these Jungian issues as she looked at these stages of development?
She was, yes.
Yeah.
And she's a therapist, and that really helped me. I looked for a while if there would be any books that would be beyond Carol Gilligan's In a Different Voice
right.
to get female development, and that was really the only book that I found.
Yeah, that's it. That's so unfortunate. And because, you know, it's so important, and it plays such an important role in every single person's life, male or female.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, what happened, of course, is that in the past two or three decades, all hierarchies were confused with dominator hierarchies, and research on developmental studies really kind of ground to a halt.
Yeah.
It just stopped and was anathema and taboo.
Yeah.
Which is just horrible loss. And only recently, with the winding down of postmodernism, have developmental studies come back on board. And so looking at the stages of development in the anima and animus is very important. And, again, people can get this idea activated in themselves just by reading your discussions and getting a feel for it and seeing, you know, what stage applies to them and taking it from there. And you go through the stages of anima development in men, and those are, one, women as mother, he needs a mommy to take care of him. Two, women as sex object, he wants her to make him feel good. Three, women as wife, he wants her loyalty and support. Four, women as guide to creativity and awakening. He struggles with her need for independence. And five, women as equal partner. He meets her as an opposite and equal partner. So that's a very important developmental line for men. Also important for intra-informed men to determine as best they can the stage of animus development in women. Because this is so often the case, similar stages are going to do relatively well, and dissimilar stages are going to have some sort of conflict. And the dissimilar stage is not necessarily a deal breaker, unless it's actual levels of consciousness, but the greater the dissimilarity in, let's say, spiritual development or sexual development, then the greater the dissonance and more areas of conflict a person can expect in the relationship.
Right.
So it is something that I want to take into account. And so it's important for him to get a sense of the stages of animus development in women. And they are five, as they are in men. Stage one is men as alien outsiders. She fears, hates, and loves him. Two, men as father, god, or king. She wants his approval. Three, men as hero. She wants him to take care of her. Four, men as independent beings. She wants her independence.
Right.
And five, men as equal partners. She wants him as equal and opposite partner. And it's at stage five, of course, that is the most highly developed and evolved. And so men and women have basically taken back their anima and animus projections and are comfortable with each other.
Right. Of course, that's what we see as we transcend. A woman needs a man as much as a fish needs a bicycle, right?
That's
per se now for, you know, like a lot of women say, well, feminism promised us all this this great life, and now we struggle through it alone.
Yeah, exactly.
And I heard some relationship experts who say, no, we need just to go back to our old values. And I go like, no, no, no.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But, you know, we can grow. And
exactly.
Unless people are informed about the growth potentials, then as you said, you know, it's much harder to grow into them if you're not even aware that they're potentials.
Right. And, of course, the people that want to go back to the way they were are often traditionalists and want to go back to good old amber values where men's roles and women's roles were about as different and as stereotyped as they can be.
Yeah.
And then those at green and postmodern are just stuck with, the, you know, this seemingly insolvable problem.
Mm-hmm.
Which is women, you know, want to have all the independence of men, but they still have the same basic biological drives.
Yeah.
And so that just leads to confusion. And we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
Certainly, for anima and animus, you point out, if a man's anima in any of the first four stages feels lonely and desperate for attention, he will experience an emotional attraction to a woman at a similar stage of her animus development, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also something that you really want to look out for, because it's not just that these stages are going to get along better with each other. It's also the first four stages are, well, for a common term, they're very needy. They're pathological, dysfunctional, and glom onto each other with a neurotic passion.
Mm-hmm.
And that sets it up for trouble.
Yep. I also want to emphasize, for men who are in, you know, where the wife wants to leave, as we know, 70% of divorces are initiated by women.
Right.
And a lot of men don't understand why she leaves, and she says, I want to claim my independence. I want to know who I am independent
right.
of you. And then the men sometimes, they tell me, but I want to support her in being independent. It doesn't see the contradiction. And the more they move in and try to support her to become independent, the more upset that modern and postmodern women very often have to go to to accept that for a man instead of killing himself is something that's important for me to bring across.
Yeah, and I
think...
And
also that there is hope in stage five, that are actually women who transcend stage four, and then, you know, to focus on women who want to co-create in stage five and not go back to a needy one, two, three relationship.
Right, and I think that's the message of the book in general, is that there, you know, there are higher stages of growth and development, and there is a great deal of hope for men and women who move into, you know, who courageously continue their growth, and in many cases do it together, which is sort of an ideal relationship.
Mm-hmm.